Thanks for coming out. Kind of a nasty night, but welcoming the rain. We'll take all we can get. The whole purpose of a town hall is for me to hear from as many people as I can what you think. There's lots of ways I get to hear from you. I get 5,000 to 6,000 letters a month or emails. If they're not duplicative, I read every one of them. If you get an answer back from me, you can bet it's my opinion, not my staffers. And I spend about 3.5 hours a day working on those, both reading and what I'm sending back to you. So you don't just have to come to a town hall meeting to communicate with me, and you're not communicating with my staff when you send me an email. You're actually getting to me. And most people, the funniest thing I see is, I know you probably won't read this, and when I see that in email, I always put in, yes, I've actually read this email. So welcome. Our country faces a lot of difficulties. We've been through a lot of tough times before. There's probably not any problem we can't fix if we try to fix it together rather than fix it apart. And so I think our biggest problem in Washington today is the lack of character-centered moral leadership, and that's Republican and Democrat alike. And so I'm trying to be a part of the solution rather than part of the problem. But my number one guidance is the U.S. Constitution. It's not the Republican Party. It is what's the rule book say, and what are we supposed to be doing associated with the rule book? And that's what I try to follow. So I'm going to just open it up. We've got some handheld mics. Well, I learned a long time ago that we don't give the mic away because I may not ever get it back in a town hall meeting. So they will hold the microphone, and we'll let you ask questions, and I'll try to answer them the best I can. So who's going first? Here, right here, front row. You're obviously not a Baptist, right?
Pardon?
You're not a Baptist.
No, sir.
I didn't think so. You wouldn't have been on the front row.
My question is in regards to the Department of Homeland Security. I've witnessed a lot of hand-wringing and worry about the Homeland Security Department amassing an arsenal of weapons and millions of rounds of anti-personnel ammunition. First of all, I want to know, is that factual? Second, if it is, how is it being funded? And thirdly, what is the Republican Party and fiscal conservative Democrats going to do about it?
Well, first of all, let me say this about any question you're going to ask. I get all these emails that are based off stuff off the internet. Please check the accuracy before you respond or react to what's on the internet. There's several organizations out there that verify the factual basis of a lot of the claims. There was a claim that Homeland Security got 2,700 armored vehicles. Absolutely false. It's already been stated to be false, but I bet I've gotten 200 letters on it. They got 36 used MRAPs to be used on the border. That's all they've gotten. We have done an investigation on the ammunition question. We're in the midst of that. You can go on my website. You can see the letter that I wrote to Janet Napolitano and her response. We're not through with that. But if you look at the data that they have given us, which we're assuming is pretty accurate right now, they're actually declining in the number of amount of ammunition at which they're buying versus 4 years ago. But anyhow, I'm on top of it. I'm the ranking member on Homeland Security and Government Affairs. I will get to the bottom of it, and whether it's factual or not, and it'll go right up there on the website, and you'll be able to find it. That's coburn.senate.gov. Okay. Where are we?
Senator, glad you're here.
I
too, support the Constitution. I'm very concerned about the recent history of the use of the filibuster in the Senate. It seems like the minority is able to prevent even votes taking place. But I've got two things I'd like for you to respond to, two issues. Part of our national health care, the Obamacare, provides for a number of new taxes. Many people use that as a criticism. I see that as a paying for rather than adding to the debt. So I'd like for you to respond to that. Secondly, about gun violence. I do not see the need for 20-30 round clips in general public hands, so I support the banning of those clips. I think there is a serious flaw in our background checking problem with not everyone playing by the same rules. So I would support a universal background check for all kinds of sales, including if you sell it to somebody else personally. Some kind of checking system has to keep the guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't be getting them. And third, the military-style type weapons. There may be those who look at those with some kind of fondness because of its military appearance, but those kind of weapons can easily be changed to automatic. So I would support the banning of those. And I'm just curious about your responses to that. And I have emailed to you those same concerns.
Well, you may have gotten an answer already. there isn't a gun that's made that isn't an assault weapon. All right. I want to address the first one that you mentioned before you got to the other three. How many of you know the history of the creation of the Senate and what our founders thought about the Senate? The Senate was the place, I'm going to try to answer it. The Senate was the place to be the counterbalance to the House. The House is supposed to absolutely respond to public opinion. The Senate was not. The senators were originally put up there by their legislatures. The 17th Amendment changed that. But the whole purpose for creating the Senate was to make absolutely sure minority opinion was preserved and the rights of the minority were preserved. You've got your facts wrong, mister. The fact is Harry Reid has chokehold the Senate to where the average senator from any state can't get an amendment. In the last 6 years, there have been less amendments offered than in the first 2 years I was in the Senate. A filibuster is, why would you vote for a bill that you can't put the input of the people of Oklahoma on? And the other thing that's happened is the vast majority of the bills that come to the floor have not been through the committee process. So you may believe what the press says, and they side that, but that you're factually totally incorrect. And I'm going to filibuster anything that I can't amend. If I can't represent your views, which you've sent me there to do, to be able to try to improve at a piece of legislation. So it's with great angst, and you can tell I'm irritated about it, because what you hear in the press is absolutely untrue. We have a dictator almost running the Senate. And the fact is, it goes against all the traditions of the Senate, whether it was under Republican or Democrat control. So I think you're in error. I believe the Second Amendment is one of the most important amendments in the Bill of Rights. And I really believe it's not just guns that are assault weapons. And so it's important for us to be very clear about what our rights are and not infringe on those rights as we try to make a real valid attempt to keep the guns out of the hands of criminals and those that are mentally impaired. And what I'm trying to do right now is both protect the Second Amendment and the 10th Amendment for Oklahoma if we want to do something different and create a way where we won't infringe on either of those amendments and allow somebody to know they're not selling their private weapon to somebody that's one of those two categories. And I think we can do it. And I think that'll prove positive benefit for the country. But and have you ever shot what you consider to be an assault weapon? Yeah, but no, you had an automatic. I'm talking about So the point is we have a right to own those. We have a right to have as many bullets in them as we want under the Constitution. That isn't going to be the thing. You know, we passed a law called the Gun-Free School Zone Act. It doesn't work, does it? Because somebody that's deranged doesn't care what the law is. A criminal doesn't care if the law. So we can pass all the laws we want. No, I'm not. You didn't hear what I said a minute ago. I want to change it so that somebody who has a gun and wants to sell a gun can know they're not selling a gun to a criminal or somebody mentally impaired. That's about as far as I'm willing to go in going towards any infringement on the Second Amendment.
Do you have specifics about what that might
be? Yeah, I have a phone conversation with Vice President Biden on my way home tonight. And I've been working on it for months. I've taken a lot of criticism from the hard right in Oklahoma because I'll even talk about it. But I'm going to try to do the right thing. But I'm not going to impinge on any of our rights guaranteed under the Constitution, period. Okay, you're right. I forgot one. You can tell I'm tired. I have a different opinion. You're getting ready. Matter of fact, there's an article out today on CNN. I don't know how many of you saw it. If you're an individual person in the individual market, or you're a small businessman, your insurance is going to at least double next year. So, and that's not a tax. That's just a consequence of the Affordable Care Act. I think the Affordable Care Act is a tragedy that we will repeal very soon after it's fully implemented, because Americans won't be able to afford the cost of it, and seniors won't take the rationing that's going to come with it. And we're going to control costs by rationing care in this country. That's what it's about. And you know, I happen to have a little bit of experience in healthcare, and I also have a little bit of experience in free enterprise, having built a business and sold it. An emergency room. Look, emergency room care is expensive, but you're fixing the wrong problem. What's the problem with healthcare in our country? It costs too much. Why does it cost too much? Because we don't allow market forces to allocate the resource. Because every one of us who has a policy or has Medicare thinks somebody else is paying the bill. And I guarantee it's human nature. When you think somebody else is paying the bill, you don't care what it costs. So we fixed the total wrong problem with Obamacare. And we had the Patients' Choice Act, which actually was a free enterprise, transparent, you could see outcomes, real competitive model, refundable tax credit for everybody in the country, covered everybody, wouldn't have problems with ER, even covered the person who had it but wouldn't do it, so the state could buy an indemnification policy to cover the state in case they didn't do it. But we could never get a vote on that under Harry Reid, a common sense way to actually solve our problems and eliminate $850 billion of waste in healthcare a year, $1 in $3, documented five times by five big studies, the two of them out of universities and two out of people that actually study that. $1 in $3 doesn't help anybody get well, doesn't help anybody prevent them from getting sick. So what we have is an absolute mess on our hands that's going to get worse. There's no such thing as insurance in this country. It's prepaid medical expense for which you get extracted about 25% to have somebody pay your bills. That's what insurance is in this country right now. We don't have a free market in healthcare. You can't go buy anywhere in the state, any state, and buy what you want. They tell you what you can buy. And you're going to make it even worse under the healthcare plan that the president forced through Congress. Okay, well, we'll disagree.
The president has a catch-and-release policy, and I know you're on the immigration board. One of the things that I think is that we're not focusing on the permanent fix so that we don't just keep repeating the problem. You know, we didn't end anchor babies by replacing birth on soil with birth from citizen. We didn't make English a national language. Both of those cost $0 to actually implement. It's just a change in the law. We need to do something that would permanently block it from being effective, such as issue a free government ID card to every citizen. You also need to direct the president and tie him up with a law so that the catch and release doesn't happen again, where we find out 5,000 illegal aliens, which may or may not be violent, have been released. I don't believe that they're required to photograph, fingerprint, DNA sample, test the DNA.
Okay, you got to have a question in there somewhere.
Okay, and
what's your question?
My question is are you going to pass a law to try and tie their hands to make it to where he can't sit there and say it's a money issue, so I'm just releasing them. I'm going to pass a law to. Would you pass a law and be willing to do those things to stop the...
Well, I'm already the prime sponsor on English as the official language of our country. I'm not going to look at immigration until we see what's coming out as a bill. Ask yourself, why are we talking about guns and immigration when our country's going broke? Why are we talking about fixing Medicare, fixing some of the $97 trillion? Look, I helped kill the last immigration bill because there's no immigration bill that will solve our problems till you secure our border and fix our visa system. 40% of the people, 40% of the people that are here illegally came legally. It's the incompetence of the bureaucracy that created 40% of the problem. And so if you don't, look, as a doctor, I'm trained to treat disease, not the symptoms of disease, the real disease. And what we're talking about is symptoms. Let's fix the real disease. The real disease is if you can't secure your border, it doesn't matter what you pass. You're going to do it again. And if you don't fix the entry-exit visa system, it doesn't matter what you do, unless you shut down nobody coming to the country to visit. So unless you fix the real problems, the real disease. You're asking me about things I can't do anything about. There's 45 senators that are of my ilk in the Senate. I can't do anything about that. What I believe we ought to reform what we're doing, yes. But I'm not going to waste any effort on it until there's something that I can actually comment on and do something about. And so is it a problem? Yes. But I would tell you, if I lived in Honduras or Guatemala or Nicaragua, I'd be coming across our border illegally because the opportunity to get a better life is here. And we ought to be proud of that. I'm not proud. And the other issue with immigration is this. It's not about being anti-Hispanic. It's about the rule of law. When we allow a certain group of people to undermine the law, what it does is cheapen the law. And it makes us think, well, if they can break the law, we can break the law. And that's the unwinding of our society. So it's not about Hispanics or non-Hispanics. It's about how do we create a system where we can manage our southern border and our northern border and know that we're going to have control over it. You know, 2% of the people that come across that border, the latest statistics, are Middle Eastern. They come across illegally. That's a whole bunch bigger concern to me in terms of radical Islam than people coming here to try to get ahead. It doesn't mean I don't want to enforce our border and I don't want to have an immigration reform bill. But I don't think those are high priority to us. We're not in a debate here. You ask a question, I'm going to finish it. It's not about... Those are not big problems if you really look at what the real big problems are for our country right now. And I would suggest everybody here start focusing on what could really unwind our country, and that's our financial situation. The fact that we're borrowing $4 billion a day that we don't have any idea how we're going to pay back, and that we're mortgaging the future of our children, and we're stealing the opportunity, regardless what kind of education they get, that they're never going to be able to support their own family. So I think we ought to fix the big problems and then worry about the small problems after we fix the big problems. Well, it's not your turn to talk, and if you want to raise your hand and be recognized, I'll be happy to try to get a microphone to you.
Senator Coburn, I saw today that Secretary Hagel's docking his pay for a little while in unity with the other people who are furloughed, the other government employees. Will you be doing the same thing?
I've given... everything above what my salary was when I first came into the Senate to charity every year, which is about $25,000.
Good evening, Senator. My name is Mukta, and I just want to tell you a little bit about myself and my husband here before I ask my question. I am originally from India. I have two master's degrees in health science and human nutrition. I work as a nutritionist here. I'm an OSU graduate. My husband here also has a master's and a doctorate in physical therapy, and he works in the city as a therapist. And we have been going through the immigration process as legal tax-paying immigrants trying to get a green card with anguish for many, many years. And we would like to know if, with the new immigration reform bill coming out, if there is any chance that the process might get any easier for us, or it usually takes 6 to 20 years of wait time for us, although we're here legally and we're law-abiding citizens, to be able to go through this process. So we're wondering if we can count on you for your support of the immigration reform bill.
These guys are really well organized. Every town hall meeting I've had somebody, I want to compliment you on that. She's talking about high-skilled visas. You know, in Oklahoma, we educate, we have about 10,000 people in our universities going for advanced degrees that are not from here. They're here legally. Legally, they're here. We've granted them a visa. And the first thing we do most of the time, as soon as they get their degree, is say goodbye. Now, we've invested a lot of money in their education. We have a shortage in most of the areas where these people work. The first thing we ought to do is give them a path to citizenship as soon as they get their degree. And the reason we should do that is selfish. It benefits us. You realize we're losing businesses all the time because we have a shortage in so many high-skilled areas that rather than try to get people into the country, they just move the business to another country. So we lose not only the income tax revenue and the jobs and the jobs that will be created by building the business. We lose it all. So that to me is a no-brainer.
Hi, I needed to go back to the gun control issues. It's a big deal to me because I'm a mother of two small children. Mm-hmm. And the Newtown shooting was, you know, terrifying for a mother. What I'm wanting to know, and I'm still unclear of, from you is if you will, do you support background checks from everywhere, from gun shows, from every single sale of a gun?
The answer to your question is if we can do that in a way that does not infringe either the Second Amendment rights of any law-abiding citizen, and number two, does not supersede the 10th Amendment rights of the state of Oklahoma or any other state. And I'm trying to figure out how to do that in a way that makes it easy and quick and accurate.
And let me say, I'm completely for having, you know, having guns and things like that. It's just like with the assault weapons, too. I want to know how you relate those back to the Second Amendment.
Because if I had a .45 caliber handgun here right now, that's an assault weapon. I can if I point it at you, I'm aiming an assault at you. So the nomenclature, all guns are assault weapons if they're used. It doesn't matter. I don't care what it is. The point is either you have a right to a gun or you don't have a right to a gun. There was a wonderful website out there after Vice President Biden said that women ought to buy shotguns. I don't know how many of you saw that, but it showed women shooting shotguns, and guess what happened? Most of them fell on their rear after they fired the first shell. And then you show them with an AR-15, and they can peel off 10 bullets and sit there and stand and stop somebody that's coming to rape them. So what you need is a full understanding of what the liberal press calls an assault weapon, which is not any different than you having a 10-clip, 45 caliber pistol versus what nobody here wants the average American citizen to have a fully automatic military-style rifle. We don't want that. Nobody's asking for that. But you're treading on very big territory. Let me make one other point while I'm because you're getting me there, and I think I need to say it. We have a problem right now with confidence in our country. We have a problem with confidence in ourselves, but also confidence and trust in our federal government. It's a well-earned mistrust. And I think one of my goals as one of the leaders in the Senate is to try to rebuild that trust. And you do that by not being partisan, but being willing, in Oklahoma, one of the highest percentage of gun owner states in the country, being willing to try to solve the real benefit of how do we actually keep guns out of the hands of felons and those that are psychotic. And there's no law we can pass that's going to be perfect. But there are laws we can pass that won't infringe what are otherwise guaranteed our liberties. And with liberty comes responsibility. Now, I had a group of people last night that really gave me a hard time in El Reno because they don't want anything. But if we can actually decrease guns into the hands of felons and decrease guns into the hands of those that are mentally impaired, what's wrong with doing that? As long as we don't impair the Second Amendment and the Tenth Amendment. That's what I'm trying to do. So let me not answer one other question on guns, because it isn't done yet. I'm working on it, and my commitment to the people of Oklahoma is I won't do anything to infringe the Second Amendment or the Tenth Amendment as I try to negotiate this deal.
Sir, I know you want to get off guns, but that's why I'm here. There's two points that I'd like to bring up. One is, I know that you keep reiterating to the group that every weapon's an assault weapon, and I agree with you, but I think for clarity, everyone here, when they're saying that, what they mean is semi-automatic and automatic weapons. So, I mean, I think for tolerance...
You cannot buy an automatic weapon
okay,
now.
Okay, just please let me get to my other point, because I think that as a fellow mother, I completely understand what the woman in the front row is trying to say. Secondly, I'd like to hear an explanation as to how background checks to purchase a gun can infringe on someone's Second Amendment rights, because I just don't see how that can be possible, because if we are doing background checks to keep felons and potentially psychotic people from getting guns, how does that infringe on their rights?
It infringes on the right if you keep a record or have any traceability. You know, here's the problem. The problem is we want to accomplish this, but at the same time, what you're telling law-abiding citizens is you have to step up and do something extra to prove you're innocent. And under the rule of law in our country, you're innocent till the government proves you guilty. And this is a very slippery slope that we want to go down. And all I can do is ask you to trust me. I'm trying to get something done. I recognize the value of trying to get something done. But if you don't understand that principle, that the fear of losing rights, as we're in a government today that has grown 89% over the last 10 years, while our incomes have declined 5%, and the encroachment of the federal government on many more of our rights, people have a legitimate reason to be concerned that anything that we would do around the Second Amendment might limit that amendment. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying I'm trying to do it in a way that will assure that we won't infringe on the amendment. Okay? We're not in disagreement. I have built a lot of trust in Oklahoma because I don't do things in a partisan way. I actually try to solve problems. And I'm working to try to create a portal under which somebody that wants to buy a gun can have an affidavit that they're not on the NICS list. The person selling the gun doesn't have to do anything except know that they've got an identification and a list from the NICS list that this person isn't on it. There's no connection to the person who sold the gun whatsoever. So if somebody's certified that they're not on the NICS list, that means they're not mentally impaired and they're not a felon, then they can buy a gun. And that solves the problem, and that'll solve 95% of your concerns. What I'm trying to do, the reason I'm not being absolute outward, because I'm still trying to negotiate what is best for both protecting people and protecting the Second Amendment. The NICS list is the National Instant Criminal Background List. Okay, I'm not answering another question on guns.
My question's not about guns. Thank you for taking my question. I have a nephew who's 26 years old. He has Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and he should have died several years ago if it hadn't been for the fact that my sister and I grew up with a doctor who now works in Panama, and my nephew travels there two or three times a year to get stem cell treatments. These are not embryonic stem cells. They came from DNA from my nephew's sister, who's an adult. They were harvested and everything they do in Kansas, but yet he couldn't get the simple injection and went to Panama. Why is this?
It's the incompetency of the federal government. look, that's one wonderful treatment that looks like it's going to work. We have 26 kids that have juvenile diabetes that went to Brazil. Same thing happened from their pancreatic islet duct, not their pancreas, but their duct. They harvested their own stem cells, grew them into adult beta cells, re-implanted them. Of those kids, 95% of them are without insulin 4 years later. But it's still not approved by the FDA. Incompetency. And it's the rule. Here's the rule how Washington works. Never do what is best for America when you can do what is safe for the bureaucracy. And so I might be criticized if I get out here and there's a consequence of that, not thinking about what may be all the benefits of actually taking a risk at the FDA and say, yeah, I think we'll give you a provisional approval to do this trial. And so the question you have to ask is, why is that? And it's that because their number one focus is their agency and their job, not you as the American people. Not without courageous leadership. I'm running for home here in real soon.
Dr. Coburn, thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you.
The question I have is regarding the confidence about which you spoke earlier. I read Breach of Trust, and you seem to end that book with a pretty high note of optimism about America. And it's about that optimism and the confidence about which you speak that I'm trying to have and trying to hold on to. How can we be optimistic about the future of America when so many people who make the decisions alongside of you do not seem to have a clue about what limited government is and the constitutional limits? Because everything that is spent, all the money that is spent, seems to be things that are not enumerated in the Constitution. The Constitution seems like something that's not even paid attention to. Can you speak on that?
Yeah, I can. Look, one of the criticisms of me by my wife is I see glasses half empty, not half full. But I want to give you some encouraging news. Do you all remember the Bridge to Nowhere? People said you'd never get rid of earmarks, didn't they? I lost that vote, got 12 votes for it. We got rid of earmarks. It happened, all right? Persistent fighting for the right thing to do. I got 12 votes. I routinely get votes in the 40s now. I used to get votes in the 10s to 15s to 17s. We put out Back in Black 2 summers ago. Listed $9 trillion worth of savings that you could do that would have no impact on American lifestyle, but would actually, or our defense, would actually get us to a balanced budget and solve a lot of our problems. Nobody read it until the last couple of years. Now I'll bet you half of the Senate has read it, and half of the House has read it, and almost every amendment that's being offered in the House or the Senate is taken from that information. So change is slow. But remember, our founders intended for change to be slow. They didn't want us like Italy. Boom, 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 boom. They wanted it slow. So I'm encouraged that we can actually solve every problem in front of us. We'd solve them a lot faster if we had great leadership. But, you know, the fact that you all are here tonight trying to hold somebody accountable, trying to learn, you're interested in what's happening in our government, is one of the key ways that we're going to change it. And so we can fix these problems. And we can't give up. There's too much riding on it. But the sooner we fix them, the better off our kids are going to be. Do you realize that the average young person in this country today is on the hook for $1 million in unfunded liabilities? $1 million. So they're going to have to work their life to support their family, to buy a home, to buy a car, to hopefully educate their kids, and also generate another $1 million. Of what we've not been responsible for. I think it's absolutely immoral. All right, where are we?
Dr. Coburn, I'd like to ask about the sequester and what you're doing to try to change that so that federal employees aren't getting furloughed and hurting our economy here in Oklahoma.
Well, I had a conversation with the president, and I said, I'll work real hard to get you flexibility so you can prioritize things. So you can get rid of all the stupid stuff and put the money where it is. He said, I don't want that to happen. He said, I'll veto it. What he wants is a sequester to hurt. What the president said was, you know, and you got to give him credit. He believes in his ideology. He actually thinks the government's the answer to every one of our problems and that we aren't capable of making the decisions ourselves to solve our problems. And so he wants the sequester to hurt. I mean, you look at it. We had a way to save air traffic controllers' jobs. He told Harry Reid, don't you dare let that amendment on the floor. It was a bipartisan amendment, 37 co-sponsors, more Democrats than Republicans. Nope, can't do it. So the fact is we have great federal employees for the most part. They're fantastic. They care about their jobs. They do a good job. But he's decided they're going to get to suffer because he doesn't want any flexibility. And he'd get it. Bipartisan, he has said. Bipartisan, both the Speaker of the House and Mitch McConnell, as well as most of the Democrats, agree that we should give the president flexibility if we're going to cut $44 billion between now and September 30th. He didn't want it. Because he doesn't want the story told that you could actually take $44 billion out of the government because it undermines his desire for a larger and more intrusive federal government. So that's why. Will I work? Yeah, I work every day on trying to figure that out. But, you know, there is an interesting thing. We actually could take all of us, and we've done that. I've eliminated 7 positions in my office, and I turn back on average $400,000 a year to the federal government, and I'll turn back close to that again this year out of the budget that's allocated to me. But what we could do is all take a pay cut so that nobody has to get furloughed. I mean, that's what we could do. But that hadn't proposed. As a matter of fact, there's been 4,700 jobs listed on the federal website for all the things from consultants to stuff that are not necessary. They're still hiring. But they're going to lay you off or some of your coworkers. But they're still going to hire people. So, you know, this isn't a truthful match right now. And the fact is, nobody can deny we better get a hold of our budget. And we better change things, because if we don't, it will spell a disaster. Don't read my second book if you don't want to hear what's going to happen to us if we don't get a hold of things.
I also work for the federal government, and you just mentioned about sequestration, so I won't go in depth about that. But one of the issues that we have a burning desire as an FTE, a full-time employee, is the contractors that are being utilized.
Yeah.
Could you comment on that?
Yeah. I put a proposal in Back in Black, if you go look at it. I put a proposal to hire more federal employees at the Pentagon to replace 65,000 troops that are there. Now, why would I do it? Not contractors, federal employees. Because one of the things, we could save a ton of money in terms of, a federal employee costs us less than a corporal. Did you know that? Fully absorbed insurance benefits and everything else. Plus, we train somebody in the military, and then we put them into an office job that a civilian can do, and we don't have somebody that's out there that can actually do what we want soldiers to do. So I'm all for doing everything we can do that's smart, that saves us money. The abuse in contracting is unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I've seen it. You know, looking at Homeland Security, which is getting close to the Pentagon in terms of size, it's unbelievable. And where we could hire full-time federal employees to do things at a lot lower rate than what we do with contractors.
Senator, my name is Jeanette, and I'm curious. I'm a constitutionalist. I know what the limits of the Constitution are. And I'm wondering if in the terms of states' rights, and the state of Oklahoma votes for nullification of the Obamacare Act, why couldn't we vote for nullification of federal government interfering in education in the state and take education back to home rule?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think you're absolutely right, we could. But that's for Oklahomans to decide, not me. I mean, I'd get a vote on it if we did it. But how many people know what the size of the budget of Oklahoma is right now? What is it? The state budget? Yeah, well, actually, it's $23 billion. It's $23 billion. So here's what you put at risk, because we've become dependent on the federal government. We got an $8 billion direct budget, and then you got about $17 billion in federal dollars that come in. That's what you put at risk. We can do nullification, but the federal government's response to that can be to say, okay, Oklahoma doesn't want to do that, so therefore we're not sending anything. So what we have to do is you have to think through that process. And I'll go with whatever Oklahoma decides. But you have to think through it. Again, I think that's fixing the wrong problem. Fixing the problem is downsizing the federal government back to the role it was intended to be. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I just had a brief comment. I appreciate, first of all, you being here. I know it's taking out time from your busy schedule, and we appreciate you coming. I know the use of guns can be properly used because I have a lot of friends that go hunting and they fill their freezers with the venison and the meat that comes from it. It's not the gun that's a problem. Instead, it's the people and how they use it. My concern is the Muslim Brotherhood and how it is growing in our country, and the Sharia law and how they're wanting to put it into the courts. I'm concerned about that because I believe it is contradictory to our Constitution. How do you feel about that?
I agree with you.
First of all, I'm a disabled veteran, and I would like to thank you and Patrick Gwynn for helping me with my case. It really helped a lot.
Right.
And initially, I was going to ask about the loose-knit definition of mental health as far as veterans and the Second Amendment, but you said not go there. So I was going to ask, what can be done about the processing in Veterans Affairs? It took my case 2 years, and I know plenty of other veterans who aren't receiving any benefits or anything for years at a time because they're so backed up with everything.
I would have to say, first of all, I have to apologize to you for our ineptitude as a government in how we treat veterans by not quickly and succinctly responding to what your needs are. And I'd also thank you for your service. The VA is adding employees faster than any other area of the federal government. It's not under the sequester. And by the way, she's gone, but I didn't vote for the sequester. Yeah, it's like mowing. When your wife tells you to go out and weed the flower bed, you mow it. It's a stupid way to cut spending. It's difficult to ramp up. What we didn't do was anticipate at the VA what the needs were going to be in time as we started bringing everybody home. And so they're working hard. You know, Muskogee has a big VA center. There's a lot of VA centers around the country. They're adding employees like crazy. I think there's 2,600 VA employees now in Muskogee. There used to be 600. So they're adding. My hope is that we'll catch up and all those times will be shortened. But if there's a veteran in here or you have a family member that's a veteran, we have a retired Army officer in our office in Tulsa that does nothing but veterans casework. And he's pretty good. He knows it, knows his stuff, and he knows how to get through the maze of the bureaucracy.
Senator, since I view most people in Washington and the Federal Reserve as kind of a financial terrorist, to rectify that problem, would you support Rand Paul's budget to eliminate federal agencies, tax code simplification, and entitlement reform that would balance the budget in 5 years?
I voted for his budget on the Senate floor.
Senator, thank you for the time this evening. This may be, I may be in error, and you can and correct me quickly if I am. My recollection is all the, and you're uniquely qualified to answer this, having served in the House and the Senate. My recollection is that all the expenditures for federal government have to originate out of the House of Representatives. And as far as I know, there's no constitutional requirement for an omnibus bill. And while you're one of 45 in the Senate, we do Republicans do have the majority in the House. And I agree that with your position that the debt is the thing that will overturn all of our lives. Give us some insight on why the Republicans will not pass a budget that funds a particular part of the government, Interior, Homeland Security, or Defense, by themselves and put them on. That way, that part of the government has a budget, and these continuing resolutions continue to pile up the debt and don't address the problem.
Well, why? First of all, you're in error. The bill that passed before we came home had seven separate appropriation bills in it that were passed by the House and the Senate. The real question you ask is, why don't we get our work done? All the appropriation bills were passed by the subcommittee by March 31st last year. Harry Reid never put a one of them on the bill. The House passed all of them. They could have been passed. They chose not to do it. Back to the gentleman, he didn't want his members to vote so that their citizens could see where they stood on issues. So therefore, he didn't bring the bills up. They could have passed. If you watch C-SPAN sometime, see how much time that the Senate spends in a quorum call. It's about 70% of the time. We've got plenty of time to do all the work we need to do. What we need is a leader that will bring the bills to the floor through regular order. And they can get passed, and they can get worked out with the House, and then we can run the government the way we should. And by the way, continuing resolutions are a terrible, terrible way to run the government because you don't give the federal employees the flexibility they need to plan for the future. So everything ends up costing more. It costs more to do it that way. So we did pass seven of the 13 bills. We should have passed them early last summer. And we didn't for political considerations.
Senator, my name is Glenn. I'm a federal employee. I've 32 years, 22 of active military. My question is, like you said, when I applaud you, because you said you gave back some of your budget money for your cuts, how come other agencies aren't allowed to do that when there's an appropriation? Like, for instance, our pay's been frozen for 3 years.
Yeah.
We're fixing to face furloughs. And yet, at the end of the year, I see because the manager has money to spend, he's got to obligate his budget. He says that he can't return money, whereas you can. Why is it? Because I seen $1.14 million paid for flagpoles. This is last year. This is right here in Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
$800,000 for playground equipment, and there was nothing wrong with the playground equipment we had. We just replaced it because they had money to spend. We just bought a clock for over $150,000, and we're going to build a park for that clock now for $2 million. Now, we got budget issues, and nobody in here is going to be able to enjoy the park because we're on a secure facility.
Yeah.
We're all taxpayers here. It's all using our taxpayers.
Yeah.
How do we control that?
Boy, that's a great question.
I mean, we're wasting a lot of money. Yeah. I see it.
Thank you. You know, I have a place on my website for whistleblowers. Please go there. We'll protect you. Go there, give us this information. This is exactly what I need to be able to change things in the U.S. Congress. Now, here's what's really happening. The appropriators and career politicians want money spent so that it benefits their constituencies. All right? That's called parochial primism. In other words, I want everything to make me look good, so I want the money spent. There is an agency that gets the following, and it's only one agency, the Department of Justice, has the ability to not spend its budget and keep it. What I've proposed in the past, I can't get any support for, is for every dollar an agency doesn't spend, they get to keep 35% of that for the next year as a reserve fund. And they can use that money to reward employees with stellar behavior. They can use it to buy things that we didn't appropriate for that are outside of what Congress has done. But that gives an incentive. I had an idea, and it'll only work once, is that you reprogram funds at the beginning of the ninth month based on what the spend out rate was on the first 9 months. Now, you can get away with that once. That'll stop that wasteful spending, but it won't stop it the next time. So what we have to do is start treating federal employees like grown-ups. Let's reward you for great decisions, and let's let your agency or you individually benefit by when you do something smart, rather than force you to do something stupid. And the whole budget, I want you to think about this mindset for a minute. We really didn't need as much money as we had this year, but we got to spend it because we may not get the money next year if we don't spend it. How many of you run your household that way? And that's not the federal employee's fault. That's Congress's fault. This doesn't have anything to do with federal employee. It has to do with Congress. So you raise a very important point. It's something we can fix. But I need ammo to be able... That's a wrong word, what we've been talking about. I need help.
I wrote letters to Langford. I didn't write letters to you.
Yeah. Well, please do. And I actually have a formal process where we protect federal employees and we watch out. If anything happens to them for giving us information, I have subpoena power. I can punish anybody that goes after a federal employee who wants to do the right thing.
I work construction, and I've noticed that a lot of people just don't have the money to get what they need done, especially people my generation, under 40. You can bet that maybe 1 in 3 people will call you back to get the work done that they need, but there's a lot of work out there that needs to be done. I was wondering why we don't raise the minimum wage to stimulate the economy. You look at places like Australia where the minimum wage is well over $15 an hour and their unemployment rate is lower than ours. Why can't we do something similar to that?
Well, there's not an economic model that would connect what you say as cause and effect. Matter of fact, all the economic models show that when you actually raise the minimum wage, you actually hurt the economy. So that's what the economic models show. And what you have to study through that is here's the following. If you raise the minimum wage, you actually increase the wage for those people who are working at that level, but you absolutely decrease the number of people who are working at that level. So the net economic effect is negative. Australia's standard of living is a third below ours. All right? Why do you think that is? Even though ours has declined 5% over the last 10 years. It's a third below ours because they have that kind of model in their economic model. Look, the best way to help young people is, number one, give them a good education, get the federal government out of our education. That's number one. Number two, create a reform tax code so that the $3 trillion that's sitting on the sidelines right now in our country will actually get invested. You talk about creating jobs and competition for jobs. What competition for jobs is what raises wages. Increased productivity raises wages. So there's never been a time that you can show economically when we've raised the minimum wage that it hadn't had a negative effect on the economy. Just the opposite of what you seem to connect would help.
Thank you for being here, Senator. My question is, how can one man like Harry Reid just hijack the Senate and not let bills come to the floor, and what can be done about that?
He has 55 votes to back him up. You can't do anything in the Senate essentially without 60 votes. And so he can do it. Now, what can you do about it? You got an election coming up in 2014. If he doesn't have 55 votes, he's not. If he doesn't have 50 votes, he's not the majority leader anymore.
None of those people are in Oklahoma, though.
Well, let me address his sidebar. How many people in here have friends or family in other states? Friends or family in other states? Almost everybody in here. When was the last time you told them what you were concerned about and you looked at the voting record of their senator and said, why is your senator voting this way and mine's voting this way? You have so much more influence than you think you do with the people around you and the people you know. And an informed citizen is a powerful tool to preserve liberty and to grow our country. And the very fact that you're here, I'm preaching to the choir, but the fact is you need to communicate it outside the state of Oklahoma. All right, we got one last one.
Yes, please.
Yes, sir.
I read that the government of Oklahoma has sold
government land to foreign countries and foreign companies, like the turnpike systems. And I'm wondering, how did that happen since they were paid for with our tax dollars? And how do we get them back so that we own them again?
I'm not sure that that's an accurate statement in Oklahoma. It was accurate for the state of Indiana. And what the state of Indiana did is I think they got $5.8 billion for a turnpike, which they have now allocated to lower taxes in their own state. So that turnpike belonged to the state of Indiana. The people, through their elected representatives, voted to do that. And in the long run, it was probably a pretty smart investment, because they took that $5.8 billion lower taxes and then built new highways with the others that they intend to eventually sell. You know, one of the ways you get out of debt and can solve some of your problems is leverage your assets. And Oklahoma has a lot. Craig, correct me. Have we sold any turnpikes? No, I think that was Indiana that you're hearing about. But if you go read the story on Indiana, it's one of the most successful states in our country today. Lower unemployment, growing personal income, growing tax base, and they actually markedly decreased the size of their state government. All right? All right. Yeah, some of you have heard things you don't like tonight. It's time to fire off an email to me. It'll give me a chance to explain better. Probably was too curt with some of the people here. I apologize for that. I'm really tired, worn out. But I appreciate you coming. My hope is that we do the things that are necessary for our kids' future. That's what I'm in this for, is to create the same kind of opportunities for our children and grandchildren that have been afforded to us. And hopefully we can do it. God bless you and good night.